Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. I'm Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have my guest, Chris Carter, who is the author of Science and Near-Death Experience, How Consciousness Survives Death. Chris received his undergraduate master's degree at the University of Oxford, and he is the author of Parapsychology and the Skeptics. And I think, Chris, are you still living in Venezuela?
No, Susan, I'm in Canada right now.
Okay, great. So, that's good. I really enjoyed your book. It has a lot of very interesting consciousness theories in it that I've had the pleasure of interviewing other authors on, so it was a delight to read. Can you tell us a little bit about how you became interested in consciousness research and the near-death experience?
Well, this is the second book that I've written in my trilogy. My third book is due out in the fall of 2012. My interest in these subjects dates back at least a decade. I'd always been interested in controversial issues in science and philosophy. But for this particular book, it actually grew out of a lengthy debate that I had with a very stubborn and dogmatic skeptic.
That's great.
Basically I was shocked by his ignorance and by the crudity of his arguments. And so I decided that a book was needed to examine the evidence that the mind can function independently of the brain.
Well, that's great. In the latter part of your book, you actually address that a little bit when you realize that probably the skeptic has more of a dogma than actual scientific investigation into something.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I deal with this in all three of my books, but especially in my first and my second. And yeah, it's important to realize this debate is something that's peculiar to Western societies, and it basically has to do with a historical conflict in the West between science and religion. Essentially, as I argued in my first book, this debate is primarily not about evidence. The debunkers and the deniers are defending an outmoded worldview in which psychic phenomena and the near-death experience are simply not allowed to exist. I mean, it's essential to realize that most of these deniers and these phony skeptics are militant atheists and secular humanists. For various reasons, these people have an ideological agenda, which is anti-religious and anti-superstitious. Now, one of the pillars of their opposition to religion and superstition is the doctrine of materialism. That is, the ancient doctrine that all events have a physical cause and that the brain, therefore, produces the mind.
Right.
So, if they conceded the existence of psychic abilities such as telepathy and of the near-death experience as a genuine separation of mind from body, then this pillar of their opposition to religion and superstition would crumble. And this, I think, explains their dogmatic denial of the evidence that proves materialism false.
Right. I saw a T-shirt one time that said, "I didn't believe in reincarnation in my last life either."
Yeah.
So. But, you know, really it is true that those of us who are able to have these experiences, I've not really had a near-death experience, but I've had out-of-body experiences and other experiences where I appear, at least, to be communicating with people on the other side because of the evidence of what they tell me that I don't know, that then I confirm. It really, belief in all of this is more experiential than I guess, evidence-based in terms of logic and reason. Once you have the experience, then, of course, you can go back and study all the theories and kind of identify which one fits within the experiential evidence, which is what you've actually done in this book.
Yes, I don't argue from a faith-based position, either religious faith or the opposite, materialistic faith.
Right. And there's experience, which is personal and thereby not objective. But if you take the experience of a large number of people, as you have in this book, you can draw some conclusions about it, and then you can fit it into various consciousness-based theories. And I think the most critical one is, does the brain produce the mind, or is the mind and... You talk about this earlier in your book. Memories may not exist within the brain. Memories may exist in another location, and we take them with us when we die, when we no longer have a physical brain.
Yes, they're really is no evidence at all that memories are stored in the brain. There's been several attempts by biologists to locate the source of memories in the brain by operating on animals. Basically, what they've done is they've taught an animal, such as a chick or a dog or what have you, some new trick, and then they operate on the animal's brain in order to try and remove those parts from where the memories are stored. There's one very... They've always failed. Every single such experiment has failed. There's even was one interesting experiment where they taught a chick... They did MRI reading of chicks' brains before teaching them a trick. Then they taught them a trick, and they did another MRI reading, and they found out that a certain part of the brain had become enlarged, presumably as a result of learning this new trick. And then they operated on the chicks and removed that part of the brain, which had become enlarged, and they found the chicks could still remember how to perform the trick. So every attempt to localize memory traces in the brain has utterly failed, and the alternative put forward by people such as the biologist Rupert Sheldrake, he's a personal friend of mine, is that memories are stored in fields, what he calls morphogenetic fields, outside of the brain.
And that would explain why once like a human is able to do something like run the 4-minute mile, then suddenly a whole bunch of other people are able to do it fairly easily. But it's real hard for the person to do it the first time.
Right. It explains why things such as the bow and arrow was invented independently several times around the world, mm-hmm. seemingly at about the same time. It seems that memories and habits of thought are somehow stored in these morphogenetic fields. I think the crux of the issue, really, that I deal with in my book, is the actual relationship between the mind and the brain. And what I think the evidence indicates is that the brain works as a two-way receiver-transmitter, sometimes from body to mind, as in sense perception, and other times from mind to body, as in willed action. The rival hypothesis, that the brain produces the mind, I believe has been proven false by the data. And what many people do not realize is that there's a lot of evidence to this effect, and this evidence is examined in detail in my book, Science and the Near-Death Experience.
The case near the end of the book where the, I guess it was a woman's name, Patty, where she had a brain aneurysm at the base of the,
Pamela.
Of the brain.
Pamela, yes.
Pamela, yeah. And she was put under, go ahead and describe what actually happened to her during surgery and how her experience probably is some of the most, the best evidence for what the hypothesis that you just spoke about.
Well, it's one of the deepest near-death experiences ever reported. The experience of Pamela Reynolds, 35 years old at the time, occurred during neurosurgery at the Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix, Arizona, 1991, and she was being operated for a giant aneurysm. Located at the base of her brain, which is basically a weakness in the wall of the large artery, which causes it to balloon out like a bubble or the side of a faulty inner tube. And unless removed, the eventual eruption of the aneurysm would have killed her. There was only one way to remove this aneurysm, and that was something called Operation Standstill. It's nicknamed Standstill by the surgeons who perform it. And it basically require her body temperature to be lowered to 60 degrees Fahrenheit. It required her heartbeat and her breathing be stopped, the electrical activity in her brain extinguished, and all the blood drained from her head. So in ordinary clinical terms, Pam would be dead. And so they did this, and during her operation, she recorded being out of her body. She recorded examining the saw, which was used to saw off part of her skull so the surgeons could get to her aneurysm and remove it. She described it as looking like an electric toothbrush. She described conversation, which was going on at the time of her surgery, despite the fact that her eyes were taped shut and her ears were had a speaker which were playing 100 decibel clicks in order to record any activity in the brainstem of her in her brainstem. And later she described entering a sort of vortex, meeting with deceased relatives, talking for a bit, her relatives telling her she must go back. She had two young children at the time. She didn't want to go back. Her brother escorted her back and basically pushed her back into her body, which she described as looking like what it was, dead.
Right.
And she
it was very inviting.
And she said it was like jumping into an icy swimming pool.
That's because she was about, 70 degrees Fahrenheit then. They were bringing her back up.
60 degrees or even lower.
Yeah.
And at that time, what they were doing was they were trying to electrically restart her heart.
Right.
And they did, and she recovered. And a few days later, she told her experience to the surgeon, Dr. Spetzler, when he did his rounds to visit her a couple of days later in the recovery room.
So that would be an experience of great evidence that consciousness actually does survive death.
Well, it certainly suggests that. Like I said before, it's one of the deepest near-death experiences ever recorded, and it was done so when this woman, began before she was clinically dead. It began when she was first under deep anesthetic, and then it continued until during the time she was clinically dead, and until they restarted her heart.
I have an interesting experience that happened. I was a trauma surgeon for many years, and I got a page at the house here, and it was a pretty bad accident. It was what we call a pedestrian MVA. The car hit a pedestrian. Of course, that is usually pretty traumatic. And so I asked about the case before I left, and I heard that the person was probably going to die. And I said, well, should I still go in? And the answer was yes. So I went into the DeKalb Medical Center, and when I got there, sure enough, the guy was resuscitated in the operating room, had some facial lacerations and facial trauma. That's why I was there. But the guy was actually up in the corner, which was interesting. And I guess I was the only person that could see and communicate with him. But he started talking to me, and he wanted to know if he should go back in his body. And I had looked at the chart, so I knew everything that was wrong with him. And he was asking me, well, how long would it take me to get, you know, to get well? And I said, well, you know, one leg's gone. You know, it was amputated. He had multiple rib fractures. He had, you know, so I kind of had a discussion with him about what it would be like for him to come back in his body versus to go on. And then he said, well, I think I'm just going to go on. And when he said that, he disappeared from the corner of the room, and then the monitors read flatline on his EKG. I mean, he went flatline then. And he was never resuscitated. It was kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, it would have been, I mean, that is an interesting story, but it would have been more evidential if he had come back and then had remembered talking with you.
Right, right. Well, he didn't. Anyway. So, I don't know, maybe I just went in to have that conversation with him.
Yeah, there's one particular interesting case which which I read briefly about. The author who wrote it up, I think, has recently passed on himself. But and I'm trying to locate it. If you or any of your listeners know anything about it, please tell me. And it's a case where there were a group of firefighters, and they got in the United States, I believe in the North, it might have been Oregon, this group of firefighters, and they got caught. They were surrounded by a fire. And so they went into they have these, I can't remember what they're called, but they're like almost like sleeping bags, but they're made out of foil, heat-resistant foil. So they all jumped into those things to try to protect themselves. And the heat became extremely intense, but they obviously did not die. They recovered. But when they recovered, they seemed to have remembered a shared near-death experience. They all remember being outside of their bodies and looking at each other. Until later on, the fire somehow passed them by, and they recovered, and that's the story. I would love to know some details of that story and interview any of the firefighters that I possibly can. So if you ever, if you or your listeners ever come across details of that, please let me know.
Yeah. I wonder if that happens a lot. I mean, you know, there was a tornado in Missouri not too long ago that, you know, could have had something similar.
Well, of course, the people have to come back to tell the tale. That's the only
right.
example of a shared near-death experience that I've ever heard. And
right.
Like I say, I'd love to follow it up.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Had you ever heard of the experiment that was done to show the existence of consciousness after death that involved the medium playing a chess game with, through the medium, a former chess grandmaster played a chess game with a current grandmaster?
That case is described in quite in considerable detail in my third book, which is going to be out in the fall of 2012.
Right.
My first book was Parapsychology and the Skeptics. That book dealt with the basis of the controversy over the existence of psychic abilities such as telepathy. And my second book, Science and the Near-Death Experience, deals with, it has three parts. Does consciousness depend upon the brain, the near-death experience, and then my final section deals with deathbed visions and compares them to the near-death experience.
Yeah, the deathbed visions, I thought was, I really enjoyed that section. I hadn't ever seen that dealt with in such detail. I think most people have, who've been at deathbeds, have experienced people saying things about what they're seeing that obviously are not seen by everybody in the room. But I like the whole section comparing, comparing the different deathbed scenes.
Yeah, they're surprisingly common. I've read articles which researchers have interviewed people who work in terminal wards, and they're surprisingly common. They were more common in the past when people tended to die at home and not in hospitals.
Maybe because they weren't drugged or at such a... their brains were still working, more... interference.
Well, sure, but even today they're surprisingly common. The research shows, actually, that heavily drugged people on their deathbeds are less likely to report a deathbed vision. Which, yeah. So if anything, hallucinogenic drugs actually decreases the frequency of deathbed visions.
Which they're really would go against the skeptics saying it was hallucination.
Of course. I mean, they're nothing like hallucinations. Hallucinations, as you probably know, tend to be idiosyncratic. They don't tend to be visions of departed friends and relatives with a takeaway purpose, which is what deathbed visions tend to be.
They're usually pretty scary, too. I mean, the ones that I've seen, the patients I've seen having hallucinations in the ICU, they're spiders and, other insects.
Yeah, cartoon figures, prehistoric monsters, that sort of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's not really the same type of thing. So what are we to conclude from the near-death, the deathbed experiences, and everything in terms of the existence of something after life? Do you consider it a body of evidence that holds up?
Well, that's fairly complicated question. The fact of the matter is, there is stronger evidence for survival of consciousness than near-death experiences, which is basically the subject of my third book, which is going to be called. Well, we haven't got a title for it yet, so I shouldn't say. In my book, I argue that deathbed visions are broadly similar to near-death experiences. Both typically involve feelings of joy. Both often include meetings with deceased friends and relatives. And both are also usually associated with mental clarity. There's none of the confusion associated with oxygen deprivation or dementia. So if these experiences are in fact what they appear to be, and I argue in my book that they are, then the near-death experience is a sudden thrust into another world, whereas the deathbed vision involves a gradual transition.
And you also said in your book that people are more likely to have the deathbed visions if they're dying more slowly than, say, if they die of a cardiac arrest or something, a traumatic accident.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, near-death experiences are associated with accidents, drownings, heart attacks, and so forth, and deathbed visions... That's right. And deathbed visions are associated with more slow forms of death, such as cancer.
Right. you take of when a person is thrust out of their body for whatever reason and ends up wandering around and really never goes to light and then wanders back, either goes back into their body and recalls that? I mean, there are experiences where they don't see the light. Is that, do you think that there's meaning to that, or they just
don't get
that far into it?
Well, yeah, I'd say the latter. I mean, no two near-death experiences, rather, are exactly the same. I mean, as I describe in my book, there's a variety of stages, and some, of course, go farther than others. The experience we talked about of Pamela Reynolds during Operation Standstill, that's one of the deepest near-death experiences ever recorded. There's others, of course, but typically they don't go as far as hers did.
And what you're saying in your book is that there tends to be a barrier beyond with which they're not allowed to go, because presumably they can't come back after that. It is a suggestion of that.
Yeah, that's certainly what it seems to be. The barrier can take numerous forms. It can be a gate. It can be a doorway, an open doorway. It can be a wall, a fence, a mountain range, and so forth. There definitely does seem to be a barrier of sorts, which they're not allowed to cross.
And it seems that the majority of people that are in that near-death experience that reach that point, the majority of them don't want to come back.
Would you say that's true? Yeah, that's true. Someone could say, well, you know, many of these people have been suffering from heart disease for years, or they're very old and frail, so it's not surprising that they don't want to come back. But there have been several cases where young people have not wanted to come back. There's one interesting case in which a 17-year-old sailor in the British Navy, he was working on some electrical wiring inside of a ship, and the wiring wasn't set up properly, and when his foot, his back was against some chains, and his hand was touched the wire, and the current ran through him, and he was electrocuted, and he found himself in a field with a blue sky overhead. And he was amazed by this experience, and then he heard soft music, and then he heard a rumbling in the distance and saw a train approaching. So he ran towards the train, which came to a stop, and he saw people on board the train who seemed to be in a misty sort of environment who were inviting him to climb aboard. So he climbed aboard this train, and the train started up again, and the passengers were all chatting away happily, and he was wondering where the train was going. And then he found himself being pulled upwards, and he thought, oh no, what's happening now? And the next thing he knew, he was being resuscitated, and he was angry at having been brought back. And so he says that next time he wants to find out where the train goes.
That's great.
So this is a 17-year-old with his whole life behind him, whole life ahead of him, and he didn't want to return.
Yeah. I had interviewed one of the authors she was an MD, who wrote a book on negative near-death experiences. But they're not nearly as common. Do you think that there might be an actual plane that people go to in negative near-death experiences that would be, say, at a different level than the average near-death experience with the blue skies and the peace and the music that the majority of people are describing?
Yeah, I have a whole chapter on my book on horrific near-death experiences. It's called Into the Abyss. Most of negative near-death experiences or horrific near-death experiences are comparatively rare. They're mostly due to the work of a cardiologist named Maurice Rawlings, who wrote a book called Beyond Death's Door. His work has been criticized because Rawlings is a fundamentalist Christian with a religious agenda to promote. But most horrific near-death experiences, they seem to be more idiosyncratic than typical near-death experience. That is, they don't seem to follow the stages of a beautiful near-death experience. However, there have been a few cases in which there have been horrific near-death experiences which have followed the typical sequence of events. That is, leaving one's body, seeming to travel to another world, and so forth. There's no hard evidence that only criminals or cruel people have these negative near-death experiences, but that could possibly be because of the smallness of the sample. But yes, they do seem to occur. People react to them in different ways. Some people see them as a warning sign and they change their lives.
Yeah, I've heard that. That may be true. And it may, you know, may actually be something that is kind of staged by guides or higher self or whatever to set people straight. You know, it could be not a true near-death experience, but something that was staged more in the dream world.
Yeah, there's a woman named Nancy.
You know.
Yeah, there's a woman named Nancy Bush. She's a counselor who wrote about the negative near-death experience, and she says that on the basis of her many years of personal observation, she writes, this is a quote, "It is my impression that among the people whose near-death experience was terrifying, those who heal most quickly and satisfactorily are likely to fit this model. That is, people who interpret their near-death experience as a warning, were able to connect it with previous behaviors they identify as unwise or downright wrong, and who then find avenues by which to modify their lives in satisfying ways." And she also goes on to say, "Not all such accounts are from people with a religious background. Some readily admit to earlier antisocial behaviors, heavy drinking, drug use, violence, trouble with the law, while others describe a more internalized history of quick temper, selfishness, or problems forming relationships." Mm-hmm. So that's Nancy Bush wrote.
Yeah. So, I mean, there could be something that is more, it's not a true near-death experience, but it's kind of a out-of-body warning that you need to straighten up.
It's hard to say. But at any rate, the after effects on people who live through a typical beautiful near-death experience are profound and long-lasting. They typically include a greatly increased belief in life after death, increased compassion for others, and reduced competitiveness. So generally speaking, the experience seems to make them much nicer people.
Yeah, and they also don't fear death anymore.
That's right.
Yeah, I've actually met a number of people who were my patients who had near-death experiences and shared them with me, and of course I was open to hearing their experiences, and it does change them in remarkable ways. And many of them had had a previous fear of death, and that shifted completely.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. So where do you see opportunities for, I guess, further research in near-death experience? Should we, maybe look more closely at groups of people that die together or have near-death experiences together? Would that be helpful?
Well, sure, it would be. Today most work on the near-death experience is not done by parapsychologists, but by medical personnel and psychologists in hospitals, mm-hmm. where data are easily gathered.
Right.
And cardiologists in several countries seem to have taken a special interest in this phenomenon, and reports on near-death experience research have been published in prestigious medical journals such as The Lancet and Resuscitation, as well as in the International Association of Near-Death Studies Journal of Near-Death Studies. So cardiologists all over the world are conducting studies basically with victims of heart attacks.
It might be interesting to see with the increasing number of natural disasters that are occurring if there would be a research opportunity there. You know, the tornadoes or the earthquakes. The tsunamis probably don't have as many near-death experiences, because probably with a tsunami, either you live or you die. There's probably only a couple there. But I would think, you know, especially people who survive being pulled out 3 and 4 days later, they could be interviewed to see if they had a near-death experience. And if they did they encounter other people?
Yeah. I report on near-death experiences. I have a whole section on my book on near-death experiences across cultures, and some people have interviewed survivors of earthquakes in China and so forth in order to gather cross-cultural reports. But the most scientifically rigorous studies of near-death experience involve interviewing all survivors of cardiac arrest during a set time period shortly after their resuscitation in hospital. And these are known as prospective studies as opposed to retrospective. And these prospective studies have several obvious advantages. I mean, the resulting sample is not self-selected. Mm-hmm. They don't, in other words, these aren't people who are coming forward with stories. These are people being interviewed shortly after being resuscitated. And another advantage is that there's a nearly identical control group, that is, the survivors who do not report a near-death experience.
Right.
And also, detailed medical records are readily available. Another advantage is that subjects and witnesses are interviewed shortly after the event. So these sort of prospective studies performed by cardiologists in resuscitation wards are probably the most rigorous scientific studies that are capable of being performed on a near-death experience. But there's another terrific advantage of doing these studies, and that's that the mental state of cardiac arrest survivors is the closest model we have to that of a dying brain. Because cardiac arrest patients, by definition, exhibit several criteria required to pronounce an individual dead, such as no cardiac output, that is, their hearts are not functioning, no spontaneous breathing, they're not breathing on their own, and usually in the clinical setting of a cardiac arrest, they develop the third criteria of death, and that is fixed dilated pupils that don't respond to light, which indicates, as you know, the loss of brainstem activity. So in other words, these people have no blood supply to the brain, they're not breathing on their own, and they have fixed dilated pupils indicating no activity in the deepest, most primitive part of their brains.
Have they looked at people at the people who did have near-death experiences versus did not have near-death experiences and try to distinguish between the two?
Well, distinguish between the two.
Like, why did one group have near-death experiences? Were they deeper somehow? Were they further dead? Than, you know, we know that death is a linear thing, not an on-off thing. You know,
it's a process, not a single event.
It's a process, exactly.
There is some evidence that people who report deeper near-death experiences tend to be objectively in more serious trouble.
More dead.
Yeah, but the question is why do some people report a near-death experience and others do not? Well, there's more questions than answers, quite simply. It could be that they all experience it, only some remember it. It could be only some experience it. We just don't know.
Well, from your discussion in the beginning section of the book, the suggestion that perhaps memories, the near-death experience, and even the out-of-body experience may not actually reside in the brain but might be in the mind, which resides somewhere other than in the brain, and the brain being the receiver of the signals coming from the mind. What do you think we have a shared universal mind, like some philosophers are suggesting?
No, I don't. I don't think so. I think that, as I said earlier, and as I argue in my book, I think the evidence indicates that the mind works as a two-way receiver-transmitter, from body to mind, as in when you perceive something, as when, you know, you feel something, you taste something, and other times from mind to body is when you decide to raise your arm or get up and walk out of a chair. So, yeah, I do think that the evidence indicates the brain is a two-way receiver transmitter for the mind.
And where does the mind reside?
Where does the mind reside?
Believe it's outside physical reality?
Well, that's outside physical reality. I think that it depends on how you define physical reality. I think there may be other physical realities. What I mean by that is it's certainly possible that there are other finer forms of matter which simply don't interact with our matter because they don't respond to any of the four forces which govern the matter that we're familiar with. It's important to remember that although a table or a chair or anything for that matter may appear solid, it's actually mostly empty space. More than 99.999% of it is simply empty space. So it's certainly logically possible that there are other forms of matter composed of finer particles which simply pass through our grosser forms of matter as if they didn't exist.
True. And that would be, I guess by physical reality, I'd be talking about the third dimensional reality that we perceive when fully conscious. I mean, when in this area. Although, if you're in a near-death experience, you can be in a different reality that appears just as real, but might have more higher vibrating frequencies, so that it would not be visible, when you're looking out of your physical eyes.
Yeah, well, I also argue that the brain not only works as a two-way receiver transmitter, but also works as a filter. It filters out those forms of experience which are not essential to the
right.
terrestrial success of organisms, physical organisms such as ourselves.
Right. So people like me who can, engage in telepathy and communicate with people who are out of their body and actually see them and communicate with people who are passed over, we simply have different filters.
Yes, I think that the brain may be a limiting obstacle and which may filter out forms of consciousness not necessary for our biological needs. Mm-hmm. And so it may be that some people are born with a sort of bypass or a faulty sort of filter. It could be that...
I was born with it because I had it ever since I can remember.
Yeah. So freedom from the body may result in a more extended form of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. I was also born without the fear of death, which is interesting. Well, as far back as I can remember. I never had a fear of death. So that's,
okay.
I wonder if the two are related, that if somehow, you don't have these filters so you can communicate with people who have passed over and know that people never really die, they just go to this other dimension that is less accessible, for most people anyway, that you don't have a fear of death because you realize that death is an illusion. So do you think that the fear of death is the number one fear that most people have?
Well, it's hard to say, really, isn't it? I think it's a fear that a lot of people have, and people deal with it in different ways. Some people retreat into the mysteries of religion. Other people simply ignore it. Other people deny it.
Or they think nothing happens so that they don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, it goes back a long way, I suppose, but these days I think that for the past several decades there's been good evidence that we do survive death. I think the evidence today is stronger than it was 20 years ago, and 20 years ago was stronger than it was, say, 50 years before that. So for about the past 120, 130 years, many top scientists and philosophers and scholars have been researching this question. And I deal with the near-death experience and deathbed visions in my second book. In my third book, I deal with the remainder of the evidence.
Are you looking at all on the evidence for reincarnation?
In my third book, yes.
Good. Yeah, I had interviewed Paul von Bord, who wrote Science and Reincarnation, I believe. And other people who have written books on that. It actually ties in well with the near-death experience research because it is, talking about memories that often children have that are then researched and either confirmed or not. So it's a very interesting line of research as well.
Yeah, and the funny thing is most people... Most people associate belief in reincarnation with Hindu cultures, the cultures of India and other parts of Southeast Asia. But the fact of the matter is that reincarnation is a fairly common belief. I mean, the Inuit, we used to call the Eskimos, they typically believed in reincarnation, as did some of the Vikings and certain African tribes and the Maoris in New Zealand and so forth. So... like the near-death experience, it's found across different cultures.
I believe the Essenes believed in reincarnation as well, and Mary, Jesus' mother, was raised in the scene. And there was something called the Angel Scroll. Have you ever heard of the Angel Scroll?
I haven't. But
Angel Scroll was Greg Braid introduced it. It was a scroll that was found in the Dead Sea and sold to a group of Byzantine monks in 1954. And it's a 1,000-word document. They translated the first 100 words, and it is believed to have been written by Jesus. And it talks primarily about reincarnation. And it begins something like, conception is not the beginning, nor is death the end. And it goes on to say how no child is, born without, I can't remember the language, but it's the idea is that no child is born without sin or flaws or whatever, that we all come in with different histories and different agendas. And so it's a very interesting document.
Yeah, Christians, fundamentalist Christians tend to get upset when you suggest that the words born again...
Born again?
He meant them literally.
That's funny.
No, many of the early Christians believed in reincarnation. There was a council,
right.
Nicaea, I think. I can't remember when it was. I think 564 or something, which they officially banned reincarnation from official church doctrine.
Right.
Yeah.
Much easier to get 10% out of people who don't believe they're coming back.
Well, yeah, I guess so.
That would
tend to increase the church's power over people, right? If all we have is one life, well.
That's right. Heaven and hell, and you can buy your way to heaven.
Yeah.
At least that was widely believed at one point.
Right.
So. Well, I look forward to your next book. I think that will be very nice and a good addition to this one. And I admire you doing this sort of research and putting all these different things together, because it's something that needs to be done. People need to take a look at what I consider is the greatest fear, which is the fear of death, in the majority of people who are here now. And I think the scientific evidence is that they don't need to be worried about it.
Yes, and my second book, Science and the Near-Death Experience, it has been endorsed by many leading neuroscientists, neuropsychiatrists, professors of medicine, and people are interested in reading some excerpts or reading some endorsements, they can go to the book's website, which has the same title of the book, so it's www.scienceandtheneardeathexperience.com.
Do you have a website for your, a personal website for your material as well?
I have three websites.
Okay.
One for my first book, one for my second book, and then I have another website on the controversy over standardized testing.
Okay.
So those are my three websites.
All right. So what is the name of the first book again?
Parapsychology and the Skeptics.
And it's the same thing, the name of the book?
Oh, www.parapsychologyandtheskeptics.com. Yeah, it's going to be re-released. A new edition is coming out with a new publisher. That's going to be in the spring of 2012, and for some reason they changed the title. I didn't change the title; it was their idea. But the new title is going to be Science and Psi, PSI, pronounced so Science and Psi.
Hmm. Okay. Well, that's great. Well, is there anything else you'd like to let our listeners know about this current book?
Not really. It's just they can go to the book's website, or they can look it up on Amazon and read the reviews. It's available through Amazon, through Barnes & Noble. It's available in many large bookstore chains as well.
Great. And I look forward to hopefully interviewing you for your next book, which broadens it even more. And basically the whole concept here is, does consciousness survive death?
Yes.
Great. Well, we've been interviewing Chris Carter. His book, Science and the Near-Death Experience, How Consciousness Survives Death, is a wonderful synopsis of the scientific evidence around this question. And you can read more at scienceandtheneardeathexperience.com. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And basically, we look forward to your next book.
Well, thank you, Susan.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Next week, we will be interviewing the author of Healing Yourself, Yukai Okawala. And on the 11th, Dr. Joyce Kovelman, Once Upon a Soul. On the 18th, Nina Sims, Moonrise, The Power of Women Leading from the Heart. And on the 25th, Dr. William Bingston will be back with Hands-On Healing. We have a Noetic Science meeting. Lake Culver will be back discussing Bigfoot and his experiences with that. He leads scientific investigations into this area, collecting evidence. And on the 28th, Dr. Gould will have a lecture, Healthy Food Choices and the Anti-Aging Diet, at the Millennium Healthcare Office at 7:30. Again, thank you for joining us. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show.